Hello, Cornelians. Welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornelians. I'm John Rawlings III, class of 2006, and the 16th president of the Cornell Black Alumni Association. As I previously mentioned in past episodes, the Cornell Black Alumni Association is celebrating its 45th anniversary this year, which is absolutely amazing. And we focus much of our year programmatically discussing the legacy of our organization. So for me, today's podcast is an incredible treat, really for me and for all of us listening, as our guests are the founding members of the Cornell Black Alumni Association. I am beyond honored to share this space with them today, and I want to take this opportunity to introduce them to you at this time. We have Irene Smalls, class of 1971, Carlton Holmes, class of 1972, Sandra Black, class of 1973, Dr. Renee Alexander, class of 1974, and Conway Boyce, class of 1975. Founders, welcome to Fresh from the Hill.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
It really is an honor to be here. Yeah, it's an honor to see you all and to be able to speak with you all today. So we're going to go back. We're going to take it all the way back. And I want to actually start before the inception of CBA, because I understand and know that two of you were on campus in April of 1969, which for anyone who knows Cornell history knows that that was a pivotal moment for our institution, our university, in its history. And I'm referring to the Willard Straight Hall occupation, the takeover. I want to come to you, Irene, and to you, Carlton, because the two of you were students on campus at that time. What are some of your memories around that particular, I would say, era, not even just the occupation itself, but that era? What were some of the pivotal things that you remember and things that you think our listening audience should know about that time?
Well, I guess the thing that touched me the most that I will never forget for the rest of my life was the dedication and the commitment the Black students made for Black progress, for Black students being an integral part of Cornell's society, all of that. And they were willing to put everything they had on the line. I mean, they were putting their lives, they were putting their careers, they were putting their future income all on the line. Mm-hmm. And they did not hesitate. They did it completely. And that level of commitment, that level of just, whew, it was almost like going through a fire. I mean, it was like a crucible in terms of that emotional, because if you understand back then, there were so few Black students. I mean, we were up 200, but there were 15,000, and we were way upstate New York, away from our friends and family and support circles and all of that. And it was us, and we had each other, and that was all we had. And I remember very well hearing on the news and seeing on the Ithaca television stations about all the sheriff deputies from all the small towns who were gathering in the Woolworths parking lot in downtown Ithaca with their guns ready to come up on campus, you know. And basically, you know, kill, you know, do whatever was necessary to take back the building. And I mean, it was just emotionally, you know, one of the most, I mean, every single fiber of my being was alive, you know, in terms of the intensity. And so the idea of legacy was so important to us at that time, because I remember that one of the Black, I was talking to Sandy yesterday, or was it Friday? Friday we were talking.
Friday.
About how one of the first Black fraternities was started at Cornell, in Ithaca, not at Cornell, but in Ithaca, New York. And so I was all excited, and I was like, oh, wow, let me go down in town. And it was a hole in the ground. Mm-hmm. There was not a plaque, there was not a building, it was a hole in the ground. And I said, this was the place where one of the first Black fraternities in the United States was founded. And all we have is a hole in the ground. And then, you know, there were always Black students at Cornell, not many, but there were always Black students at Cornell. And they had been no marker, no remembrance they had gone through. It was like they were never there for the most part. And so it's almost as if we as Black students coming in 1967, 1966 were reinventing a wheel that had been, shall we say, tried and true and finished, but we had no connection. We had no legacy on which to build. And so in that group, that 70, class of 71, 66, 67. I mean, we started to connect with each other. Number one, there were more of us and we could see each other more often, but it was so vital that we connect with each other. You know, there's always the anecdote, why are all the Black kids sitting at the lunch counter together? Because we need each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, SEBA, after all this experience, I mean, this literally horrific, you know, deputies, you know, guns and all this other stuff. And, you know, understand that we were the good kids. We were the ones who did our homework. We were the ones who followed the rules. We were not street radicals. We were not even street kids for the most part. We were the goody two shoes. And here we are marching and doing all this stuff. And so it was like, whoa. After all that happened, I mean, half of my class did not graduate on time. Half of the Black students in 1971 left Cornell, dropped out of Cornell, failed out of Cornell. The emotional price was so high that Sandy and I were talking about a third of her class did not graduate on time. We paid a price for all that we gave emotionally and psychically, you know, to the Strait, to Warri House, to Africana. We paid. And after I had graduated, one of the things I really felt strongly was that, you know, in Jungian psychology, they have the concept of a place of containment. It's a place where you can be safe, where you can sort of divest your emotional, psychic wounds and pains and, you know, in complete confidence and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so after all having gone through hell and high water and back a couple of times, you know, we were going off to Cleveland, to Chicago, to New York, to, you know, West Philadelphia. And we had just been through all of this hell together. And there was no means of us processing that, being able to kind of heal ourselves. And was it Zora Neale Hurston said, "I am not tragically Negro." And quiet as this cat, Black people have a good old time. You know, we had a good old time at Cornell. And it was important that we maintain our psychic and emotional being. And what I saw in SEBA, the Cornell Black Alumni Association, was a place of containment, a place for us to maintain our legacy, that, you know, the hole in the ground, you know, we would not be a hole in the ground, that we had given so much. And I mean, given everything we had, there was nothing left, you know, in terms of all of the risks that we took and put it on the line. And then we just go, okay, bye. Excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
I need to, you know, I really was the, you know, that, you know, that's the phrase is that I spent 10 years there one night. It was that intense and that important. And so, SEBA was something I thought about for a while. And I said, we need to heal because, again, we need a place to be somebody. We need a place in, we are at Cornell, but we're not of Cornell. We're from our neighborhoods. We're from our communities. We're from our Black families. We're from our Black churches. And so those were the kinds of elements that could heal our psychic and emotional bonds that we had just experienced. And we weren't devastated, but we were wounded.
That's so powerful.
And so the wounds needed a place to heal. And that's what Warri House was about, that Black women could do their hair and fry their hair with the hot coal and not have people talking about drugs or whatever, that we had a place to be somebody and we could be Black at Cornell without apology.
Yeah.
That we would have a place that spoke of us, from us, and also spoke back to all the grandmamas and, you know, who well wishes and sent us off to Cornell. And who was it? I guess it was Jackie Davis was talking about her calling her mother and saying, you know, Ma, and Ma said, "Are you under that building?" She said, "Yeah, I am, Ma." And these women have sent us with their best wishes, their best hopes, and we're acting a fool, total fool. And so again, SEBA was a way to normalize, to connect Cornell's past and all the sacrifices and the commitment we had made into a concrete future. It was meant to be a conduit that we could heal, that we could come together, we could laugh, we could reminisce, we could be ourselves.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. I think, and that's so powerful. And we're going to continue on that vein, but Carlton, I want you to jump in as well. Sure. My understanding is that you were actually in the Strait.
Yeah. I was one of the Black students who marched on Willard Hall on that April 19th morning. And funny, as I relay the experience to my friends, I tell them it was 18 days after my 18th birthday. So it's kind of a special connotation for me. Mm-hmm. And, I've Frank Dawson, who also, who produced the Agents of Change documentary, mm-hmm. we were there together. But to me, and I echo a lot of what Irene said, we were right smack dab in the middle of the civil rights movement. We were like literally at the height of the civil rights movement back mm-hmm. in 1968, 69. I mean, it wasn't just Cornell's campus that was going through this. It was everywhere. I mean, you have lots of different campuses, buildings were being taken over. Black students were not being recognized. They wanted to be recognized. It was like Irene said, it was like we were the invisible students on campus. You know, there was a whole white society with fraternities and sororities, and we just were not part of that. But what we did, we found strength in numbers and in ourselves, you know. And I told the people who went to Cornell, my daughter went to Cornell later, my niece, and I said, back in those days, every Black student knew all the other Black students on campus on a first name basis.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All spoke to each other. Mm-hmm. We all knew, we all tried to engage people. Everybody didn't want to do that, but most people did. We partied together, mm-hmm. and we looked forward to those days. We really did. So we developed our own sort of little social network at Cornell, which helped us to thrive and survive. Mm-hmm. It really did. I mean, And to this day, I'm still good friends with a bunch of brothers who I was freshman with at Cornell. As a matter of fact, we just had a Zoom birthday call for my 70th birthday last Thursday. So that was pretty
cool.
Don't
tell me you're 70, Carlton. Sandy and I, we're not even talking age here. You can't do that. I'm not even letting you do that. Okay, go ahead, Carlton.
So back to Cornell in 69, April 69. And so, you know, black students, we were being treated unfairly. We were being called names on campus by people. There were instances where from a grading standpoint, we weren't being treated fairly or equally as some of the other white people were on campus. Mm-hmm. Set a list of things that we wanted to accomplish. We were trying to get an Africana Studies Center going and a program. And, you know, it seemed like the administration had we don't want to deal with that sort of attitude about it. So, you know, we knew that if we didn't take action, that nothing would happen. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, it mirrored what was going on in the rest of the country around for the civil rights movement. You sit here, you don't do anything, nothing happens. So the night before, we got together at the then Africana Studies Center. You know, we were told to come and wear warm clothes, and we were fresh. We were freshmen then, and the freshmen were down with it. We all went. We did it. We all went together, and then about 6 a.m. on that morning of April 19th, Saturday, April 19th, we all marched from there over to Willard Strait Hall, and it was like we're taking the building over. And one of my own personal stories was that it was Parents Weekend. So, and Willard Strait Hall had rooms in it. I don't know if they still does that, hotel rooms.
Right.
So one of the sets of parents, as it turned out, were the parents of a guy I ultimately went to work for a couple of years. I was at Johnson & Johnson. So, I mean, you know, his parents, he was ahead of me. He was in the class of 71. And his parents were kicked out of the Strait on that morning, along with the other parents that we had. So we went and took over the building. I mean, we were there overnight for about, I guess about 36 hours, as it turned out. We finally marched out on Sunday afternoon. They managed to do some deals with the university, and we got a lot out of this. And a lot of people, not only on the university side, stuck our necks out for us. Mm-hmm. And as Irene said, there were state troopers ready to take over the building. They were ready for bloodshed. Mm-hmm. You know, let's show these Black students that they can't do what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you know, heads prevailed, and that didn't happen.
Right.
And quite honestly, when I was there, I didn't realize what a historic event this whole thing would turn into. I mean, you know, I was there. We needed to get some things done. We did it, and that's the way it worked out. Also, Irene mentioned that one of the fraternities, DU, which was known as a white jock fraternity, they took it on themselves to try to retake the building on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well, that effort failed. I won't get into any details, but it was failed miserably.
But you know, the other thing is that we can't forget that the SDS, you know, the role that they played.
Yeah, we're in support of it. Absolutely.
They were outside passing out leaflets and information about the takeover. They were the group, Dave Burak, you know, and, you know, as I said, you know, they were the ones who went downtown and got the guns that were smuggled into the Strait and so on and so forth. And so the sense of being so totally alone and isolated, you know, was not as bad. You know, we had, and it was, yeah, as I said, in the back, you know, you got the fumbling around and stuff like that. But as I said, that, you know, oh, I'm trying to remember who was talking about that, repelling these, you know, these white jocks, you know, who were trying to break in the building, yeah, and so on and so forth. And SDS, you know, was there supporting us. So let's shout out to Warren.
Not only did SDS support us, but we had support from other from a lot of Black students from other colleges in the area.
Mm-hmm.
On that Saturday, we had other Black students come to the Strait to stay with us to show their support, mm-hmm, for the takeover. So it was great. And so after it was all said and done, so now this, you know, the takeover is done. The university has basically capitulated and given us a lot of demands that we had given them. Mm-hmm. And you know, you come to realize that, you know, after now I'm at Cornell for years, and the amount of Black people exploded on campus, you know, following our year. I mean, my class, I think, doubled the number of Blacks on campus. I think the next class doubled it again. I think the next class doubled that again. Wow. So, I mean, at one point, there were like over 1,000 Blacks on campus at the height. I don't know what the numbers are today, but I don't think it's quite that strong. Mm-hmm. But after graduation, getting to know all these brilliant Black people who were different backgrounds, who could do all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you thought about it, boy, you know, we should keep this network together. And what helped inspire me to work on this was Irene a lot, because Irene and I actually worked together briefly coming out of that. So we were sort of connected. And but then we realized, wait a minute, there are other Ivy League schools that have Black Alumni Associations, but Cornell doesn't. Harvard had one. So we said, wait a minute, Harvard has one. She should have one too. I mean, all this talent, yeah, that's there. So let's do something and put it together. So, mm-hmm, I think after that, you know, things started coming together. That was in 1976. Funny, I've got some documents and minutes. If I can always take pictures of those and send those to you.
Please, yes.
One of the from Chase, the original bank statement and corporation statement. And I've got here as Conway as the president, and Irene as the vice president, and I'm the treasurer listed on this document. So
wow.
I'll
send that. I've got minutes of a meeting. I've got a follow-up note we sent out to the students following update 77. This is a letter which was sent out saying, you know, what a great time. We're thanking everybody for coming. What a great time we had. So, you know, our goal was just, again, what I saw it as is just getting people together, establishing a network, and developing this vast resource that people could tap into and utilize moving forward. So you
know, one thing
that was my initial hope.
Right, right. You know, I think you're exactly right. And I guess that the I want to shout out to Sandy Black, because you know Sandy Black was an engine. You know, she was a little engine that could, because she was, you know, I had the idea, you know, Carlton and I had worked together, and, you know, Sandy was right there at the beginning, and my girl worked and made, you know, the network explode. And I guess one of the things that I thought about too at Cornell was those white students worked their networks for jobs, for housing, mm-hmm, for fellowships, for internships and all of that. And Black students didn't have that. And in that we didn't come from backgrounds that afforded us, you know, the country club memberships and the, you know, the European vacations where you networked, you know, at the country club and all of that, that we needed a way to connect. And as Carlton said, all that skill and all that expertise, all of that knowledge, all of that, you know, connection, not to mention the soul connection of just looking at another Black face and seeing yourself affirmed.
Mm-hmm. And that was so important, yeah.
Yes, Carlton was so right to connect all of that talent. That was exactly, you know, after the emotional and psychic wounds and healing and stuff like that, let's get down to business. Because the idea when we, one of the reasons why we went for college education is to improve ourselves economically and let that happen, you know, based on the, all of the folks that we have connected with and we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is
I think when we first talked about the organization, you know, the goal was simple. Just have an organization that would keep us in touch with one another. And you know, that was the ultimate goal. Of course, we far surpassed that over the years. I'm so happy to say and to see. Mm-hmm. But it was as simple as that. And of course, networking was starting to be, people were just into networking. But for us, it was an all important mission to keep us all in touch.
I love that. I mean, and clearly that's still happening today. Conway, I wanted to see from your vantage point, when you first got involved, what were you thinking, right? What was one of your roles? It seemed like on one of the documents you were listed as the president at some point in the very beginning. What did you see for the organization really starting out at that point?
Well, the first thing is that we really wanted to create a safe space where we could celebrate our accomplishment of not only leaving Cornell, but being successful moving forward in life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been stated about networking, you know, because at the time networking was pretty popular. But I remember clearly one of the values of being at Cornell is that we were all family. Mm-hmm. And as a family, we knew how to study together. We knew how to help each other get over in terms of being successful. And we also knew how to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the whole thing about SIBA was an opportunity to celebrate, you know, coming together to be able to be in membership, be able to have a good time, network, and to really consider, and I think this is what it evolved to, is how we could foster institutional development. And so when I look at SIBA, you know, in terms of who would have ever, even though, you know, you have vision and, you know, my cohort, Renee Alexander, you know, you need people around you who kind of, you know, and Carlton and Sandy and Irene. I mean, you know, when you, as far as I'm concerned, I had the benefit because I was a junior guy. Okay. You know, and so it was like we were able to come together, establish vision, work collaboratively in order to create an institution. And we did not have fear of being able to accomplish that.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Now, Dr. Renee, I'm coming to you. First of all, I need to let everybody know, I have to call you Dr. Renee because one, the majority of our young alumni and you know, even current students, that's how they know you. I mean, you've had a thread, you know, throughout the years at Cornell, having been, of course, a student and an alum, but also someone who has worked at the institution and impacted so many lives. So I want to make sure that everyone knows that that's why I'm referring to you as such. I wanted you to talk a little bit about Update, because this is something I've heard you mention before. And I, of course, most folks may not know, especially our, you know, younger alumni, newer folks may not know what Update is, but of course, they're very familiar with Reunion. But it was something a little different back in 1977. Can you touch on that for us?
I can. And let me begin by saying that, you know, props to all the comments that my colleagues, my buddies have made here. I want to start, if you don't mind, just give me a minute to talk about arriving at Cornell in the fall of 1970, when the dust from the occupation was really still in the air. Mm-hmm. All right. And that tension that political and racial tension was still very much a part of what I experienced. I noticed the racial segregation on campus. It was impossible to ignore how we were really defined by racial groups while we were navigating campus. But a very important memory is even though Willard Strait had just occurred, people were talking about it to this new freshman class. Now, mind you, I arrived at Cornell in the fall of 1970. We were the first class. My class was the first class to apply for admission after the takeover. We applied in the fall of 1969. The occupation took place in the spring of 1969. So that event drove the admission cycle for the class for the fall of 1970. And there were so many of us on campus. There were about 275 Black students that enrolled at Cornell that fall.
Wow.
Racial data, I can tell you, was not nearly as well captured and organized as it is now, but the numbers increased exponentially, substantially. So the occupation, there was a cause and effect between the Cornell, the class of 69 and all the participants, the occupation of 69 and the admission, the enrollment for my class 74 and for Conway's class 75. That class had just about the same number of Black students. It drove the policy of admitting more Black students. As my colleagues have shared, a big part of why I wanted to get involved in this was to keep the network going. The network was powerful. In fact, it's pretty much all I had at Cornell, was the Black community. So when we formed the organization in 1976, the next step would be to organize people and get them back to campus. In the fall of, in the summer, I guess it was June. Was it June?
Yes. Yes.
My perspective, mind you, and I'm glad you mentioned it, is that I have worked for the university and I can now look at this through the lens of administrator. Looking back at it, as we planned the update and branded it update, we planned this organization without any knowledge or input from the university. Why would we do that? Why would we not seek support, input, resources, because we really didn't have a relationship with the university. So we organized, we came up here and organized this reunion without letting the university know what we were doing. We didn't fill it up, basically, without even thinking about the impact, the consequences, what the next steps would be. But we had a blast. We had a blast. We got people to come up here and follow us up here from New York to basically turn up and turn out. And little did we know, when you talk about what impact did that have on the university, in not so many years after that, they would start an office called the Office of Minority Alumni Programs, capture the experiences of these affinity groups, of which CBA, the Cornell Black Alumni Association, was the first. We were the first. We did this. In fact, I can say, at least for me, I wasn't thinking 45 years out. We were thinking, what can we do to capture the network, the experiences, the relationships, the things, and to really mitigate what we saw as some of the imbalances, like Irene spoke about the networks that our white counterparts had at Cornell. We didn't have that. We were in the makings, but I certainly dragged out of there in 1974 without a job and without the benefit of what we would learn to be our white colleagues were doing all along and doing very successfully. So Update really gave us, I mean, we came up here and had, and I say here because that's where I am right now. I'm speaking to you from Ithaca. Who knew I would be living here after all these years? But we brought our caravan up here and turned up and people took note. And we set the precedent for having a reunion every 3 years because let's face it, this is where it all started. So we leveraged the Cornell energy by bringing our posse and returning to the scene of the crime.
And may I just add to that, you know, in terms of my freshman year, the class of 73, we came in right on the heels of the takeover in September of 69. And we were excited because the university had agreed to the demands, and the Africana Studies Center was started. And the first center, unfortunately, burned down.
Mm-hmm.
April 1, 1970, we came back from break to find our beloved center in rubble. And so we students, and we numbered 135 freshmen, which was the largest incoming a number of Black students to date. We knew that racial tensions not only were high, but were gonna continue to exacerbate given the situation if we did not band together and make sure that that the needs of Black students were met. And so that was some of the of what we encountered when we during our freshman year. Mm-hmm. And so it was the struggle was continuing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to echo on that as well. Class of we came on campus in 71, and again, we had the benefit of all that was done prior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think back to my COSEP, you know, experience that summer, and, you know, just coming on campus, and, you know, Cornell seemed like a place, like it was like another world. But because of the affinity of the Black students that were there through COSEP, I guess the university at least was aiming to create, you know, an environment that would support student success, college student success, that it made a difference, you know. And when I think back to it now, I don't know whether or not only myself or many others would really been able to maneuver your way through that institution.
You know, Conway, you mentioned COSEP. I think we have to call out the name of Dr. Gloria Joseph, because she was a godmother, a mentor. She was a fighter. She was someone who you could go to and sit in her office and tell her absolutely anything. Mm-hmm. And she would listen. And then she'd begin to say, okay, well, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
And so when I got there, as I said, in 67, there weren't that many Black students. So there weren't too many people I could turn around and say, well, what about this? So how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, the point of SIBA, the point of legacy, the point of continuity, the point of, you know, maintaining relationships was that, you know, the classes behind me could turn around and ask me, or they could turn around and ask Sandy, and they could turn around and ask Renee, that there was someone they could turn around to who right. could look at them in the face and look just like them.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, the whole thing about Warrie House in terms of starting Warrie House, the fight that I had with the university, because I was adamant that they shouldn't have a white male psychologist evaluate a young Black girl from the inner city. To me, that was oil and water.
Mm-hmm.
They came from mm-hmm. totally different worlds. But the university was insistent. And so that's really what the struggle was in terms of fighting so hard and, you know, getting her out of the dorms, getting her evaluated by a Black female psychologist. It was important that we be defined in and of ourselves, and that we are not less than.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are human beings with equal rights, equal feelings, and should be evaluated fairly. And so, you know, the beauty of SIBA is that that legacy continues for 45 years. I am so excited and so proud, and so proud of all of you, you know, and all the work that we've done, and see it, you know, manifested today in Mr. Rollins there, 16th president.
Thank you. No, it's, you all, I mean, you all have paved the way. And again, this is why this conversation is so important, because I know, you know, we often reminisce on our times on campus or major events like the occupation. But I think to be able to hear from you all, especially around the creation and really the inception of SIBA, has been amazing. Now, you kind of leaned into my next part of the conversation. You know, so what you all saw back in 1976 was this need, you know, to be connected and to be in community together and to network. So that has happened very clearly over the last 45 years. And we have seen how the organization has grown from your vantage point. Let me go to Sandy first. What are some of the things that you've seen? What is the growth that you've seen or that you're happy to have seen over this last 45 years through the organization?
Well, what I wanted to say that I've just been happy to see the wonderful positive growth that SEBA has experienced in all directions, from visionary leadership that you have shown to scholarship, like the original John Henry Clark Scholarship that we started with assistance from the university. I've seen your leadership adapt to this virtual world, communicating and engaging with alumni. And this has happened even during this pandemic. And I want to touch too on what Conway mentioned, this sense of family. And it has transcended 45 years of this organization's founding. Mm-hmm. That I think just stays with me because I've always considered Cornell alumni and the Black alumni in particular my family. And I am just so happy to see that this has remained a constant. And I can tell from the alumni, from the students who are there now, that this sense of family still exists.
Absolutely. Anyone else want to share? I don't want to, have to point anybody out, but go ahead, Carlton.
Yeah, I think what Sandy said is right on. Some of the things I see are first of all, the scholarship funds. I mean, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And that's good to see because, you know, there are a lot of kids who can't afford to go to colleges like Cornell.
Right.
We should encourage them to do so. And if we have the resources to help them, that's a great thing. I mean, I'm in a couple of other organizations and it's all about, you know, mentoring and trying to encourage and get those young Black students, engaged in colleges, especially Black males. I understand that it's just that becomes more of a problem. More so than even Black females getting them into and through college successfully. So that would be a good thing. The other thing is that I like the fact that you're doing networking events, and it's regional and that's great. I'd like to see that continue. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great way for not only for people to connect in the same years, but also in the various classes, and you can meet people. I can meet younger alum and we can share stuff. I have a daughter who graduated in 12, and I have a niece who graduated in 10, and they have a bunch of friends that they're friendly with. We all go to the Cornell Columbia basketball game together every year here in New York City. That's a great thing. The other thing I want to do is just congratulate you. We also went to the Black Panther screening in downtown Manhattan.
Yes.
That was a Cornell event. That was very exciting. So things like that, I think, on a lighter note, but to encourage people to continue to connect on a regular basis. I think those are all good things.
Absolutely.
I think the one thing, I mean, you know, I'm a hellraiser from way back, unfortunately. And in my older age, I'm still a hellraiser. And I guess the one thing that it's important to me is that SEBA stands strong when there are positions that need to be taken with the university around Black students and Black enrollment, Black scholarships, et cetera, that, you know, back then, you know, when we were 19 and 20 and didn't know what we were doing, I mean, we stood strong, we fought. And I guess, you know, it's good to make nice, but I think there are times where you just have to say no, you know, and I think that's the SEBA that is near and dear to my heart. You know, it came out of all of this turmoil and pain and real suffering. And we predict something so great and so beautiful that it's endured for 45 years. I mean, Warri House has been around for, you know, like 50 years, and I'm just beyond thrilled about that. But we also have to make the tough choices. We also have to speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not forget our legacy. Let's not forget right. where we came from. Let's not forget those folks, you know, who didn't graduate or, you know, whatever. Let's not forget the hole in the ground. Let's always keep our eyes on the prize. terms of what we are trying to do in terms of moving the Black community forward and to recognizing the that Black lives matter, you know, at all levels. Because I guess when I was at, you know, Cornell, we had outreach programs down in Ithaca. We were working with the Black students, you know, at Ithaca High School. We were working with the Welfare Rights League, and we were working with, you know, low-income Black people in Ithaca, in Tompkins County. Because I remember when I went to Warrie House for one of the reunions and they needed some work around the house, I said, oh, well, let's see what Black, you know, contractors we could find. And there were like almost none. You know, they could only find white contractors. And I'm like, wait a minute, where'd those people go? They were around when I was here. And so I guess those are the kinds of questions and concerns that I have. You know, how are Black businesses doing? You know, all of those things that really impact the diaspora. Because when we were at Cornell, we went to when the first Black mayor was elected in Newark, New Jersey. We all got in somebody's car and went down. We had cheese sandwiches and we were volunteers. And I was saying, cheese sandwiches, where's the meat? And I was very basic about it. But I'm saying there was a sense of connectivity and the sense of real commitment. So I guess that's the thing that I would want to say gently, is that SIBA, speak the truth to power. Say the harsh words sometimes. Mm-hmm. Say, wait a minute, no, you can't do this to the Africana Center. Or no, you know, this SIBA stands and this is SIBA's position on that. So it has to be all of it. You know, the family is important, but we got to protect our family. Mm-hmm. And our family is, you know, not just the people who are on campus, they're the people who are coming. So we want to make sure that we have an environment and a place of containment for them, and SIBA will continue.
Things I'd like to add that I think SIBA has captured is that we are a group of people who have established vision. Mm-hmm. And I'm not only talking about the people who are sitting around here right now. However, it's the business of being able to recognize that as visionaries, we have a responsibility that we can influence policy. Mm-hmm. That we can influence what's going on within many institutions. And I, one of the things I have valued is to see how SIBA has been very intentional to highlight those alumni who are true visionaries, people who are really out here establishing policy, being able to influence how not only how African Americans will be able to be successful in America. And I think the more that SIBA is able to capture that, particularly Cornell alumni, mm-hmm. who are real leaders and are purposely casting vision that's going to change the landscape of how we will live and be successful in America.
Absolutely. Renee?
Yes. Thank you, John. I'm going to speak again as an insider who has this experience of working for the university. In the words of the current vice president of student and campus life, who you deal with, John, Ryan Lombardi, who I had the pleasure of working with, Ryan has an expression about Cornell that goes something like this. Cornell is not perfect, but it is exceptional. And having worked inside the university, and for the first time in my life, having the word minority in my job title was less than a pleasant experience. And so what I mean by that is I was able to understand how the word minority, not just in this Cornell setting, but across other institutions, took on the meaning of the subtle implicit meaning of inferior to or lesser than. Mm-hmm. Okay, the program was really set aside and not considered a mainstream program, and that was a fight that I had to fight to move minority alumni programs forward in the institution. So where am I going with this? That SIBA is bundled with minority alumni programs, which is now diversity alumni programs. That was a big shift mm-hmm. when we were able to change the name.
Yes.
What SIBA has been able to do over the years is gain respect. Okay.
Yeah.
Just because we started this organization and implanted it, and fortunately, it took root and has grown and has been blossoming and flourishing. And in fact, I believe has become the gold standard in the Ivy League, if not across most predominantly white institutions. But over time, we've had to earn a respect that I don't think that we had at the very beginning, just because of this subtle perspective of minority being inferior to or lesser than. And that was applicable to a Black Alumni Association that was just getting started. I think that SEBA has earned and commands respect at the university now that we had to lean into and we had to earn it. Okay, just because we started didn't mean we got it off the bat. But I think that SEBA is a highly respected organization, alumni organization at Cornell University. But just because, like I said, we started it didn't mean that we got that automatically. So through our leadership and through our continued growth, we have earned the respect of the university.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. So again, we're at this pivotal marker, 45 years, right? What do you see for the next 45? What do you feel for the next 45? Or what are your wishes for us moving forward as a organization, association, as a community?
I would like to say that my hope for SEBA in the next 45 years is that it continues in this positive vein, and that it learns from its history and continues to embrace the successes that it continues to realize.
Absolutely.
I have a thought. One of our Cornell brothers, Ron Ferguson, talks about the education gap and the need to involve younger Blacks, and to get them going, to help them succeed going through high school and getting into and through college. I don't know if the Cornell Black Alumni Association works with other alumni associations to form something that can be do some kind of mentorship program or to work together. To try to encourage those high school students to come in and get through and to get them into the types of professions that need more African and Black students to do it. Mm-hmm. For example, you talk to people who at Meharry Medical College and they're having trouble recruiting Black males into Meharry. Can you believe it?
Sure.
And so, you know, what kind of things can we do as an alum, as an organization, to try to do that? And what I say that not only but that because when I was coming out of high school, there was an organization called, we call it the NESFNS, and the national, and it was an organization set up to, again, encourage, you know, Black high school students to come to colleges. The person I got to meet at one of these NESFNS conferences was Dr. Gloria Josephson. Through her encouragement, I was able to she said, "Oh, Cornell sounds like a great place to go. I think I'll do that." And my God, it worked great for me. So I'm just wondering if you're doing anything like that, if we can do more things like that to help get people into and successfully through colleges.
Okay. I worked as a children's author for a number of years. And, you know, having grown up in segregation, going through integration and the Black, you know, civil rights movement and blah, blah, blah. I mean, we have to start younger. By high school, it's too late. That we have to deal with young Black males, their aspirations, their beliefs about themselves, their beliefs about what they can attain at younger and younger ages. Because by the time they get to high school, they've not taken the right courses, they don't have the grades to get into a place like Cornell. So I think, you know, as the twig is bent, the tree shall grow. And we have to start beginning to see about how we can connect with younger and younger Black students, and particularly younger and younger Black males around education. Because again, you know, my family's from South Charleston, South Carolina, and I actually have a Southern accent. I don't have it most of the time. But I saw through the generations how my family changed, how the Blacks who came from the South were so fervent of education, get an education, you can get ahead. And then the next generation, the education didn't do that much for you. But then there were the 60s and Martin Luther King and things opened up and so on and so forth. But now it's almost like we're going back. Where the educational opportunities, for one thing, when I went to Cornell, I had a scholarship. Everybody I talk to in college now has loans. I keep saying, well, where are the grants? Where are the scholarships? You know, the funding has really dried up, but also a lot of the aspirations and the beliefs have dried up too, because we don't have, you know, Black people telling you, you can succeed, you know, you're wonderful, et cetera. And that's one thing that segregation really gave to Black people. We had this, you know, sort of cradle of Black creativity, Black talent that was there to push us forward. And I'm saying in terms of Ivy League organizations, and Ron Ferguson is excellent in terms of the research he's done about Black students, and we have to get our males, but we got to get them younger. High school is much too late.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see SIBA continue to create programming for alumni that's going to keep alumni vested in the organization. And I think the only, and I applaud your efforts, the efforts of SIBA, for example, in terms of establishing, I've seen economic development opportunities being presented to other alumni, come together, let's invest together. I've seen fellowships established for other alumni in terms of authorship, you know, people wanting to write books. You know, those opportunities where alumni can really not only be part of an organization, but really feel vested because they're getting something back. Yeah. And I think that when you get something back, then you're also willing to give forward. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I think the more opportunities that can be created where you really want to have alumni feel real vested in the organization, to really be a part of, again, establishing not only economic development, but also being part of an intelligentsia that's really going to cast a vision for the future. Because I think too often when we go, when we leave Cornell and we go to our respective places, you know, a lot of us are really not around people who are part of that. I think it's a great opportunity for alum to recognize that, you know what, you always have a home that you can come back to that's going to support you, that's going to help you develop what your gifts are, and that you'll be able to not only develop those gifts, but also give back. I think the more that the Alumni Association creates that kind of relationship, I think the more it will thrive.
Nonwe, if I may speak, I think you hit the ball out the park. And we have to remember that our primary mission is to serve alumni, that this is an alumni organization. So let's keep on providing something that keeps our alumni engaged, giving them something to stick with us. I do want to say too, though, and I think Carlton and Irene hit on it, that this issue of around preparation gap and the issue of access and affordability are going to be on the front lines of getting students and maintaining students into a highly selective university like Cornell. And finally, I want to mention the work that John Rawlins is doing and understanding the importance of focusing on the student experience, which I had a chance to do for most of my years at Cornell when I segued out of transition out of alumni affairs into student and campus life, that we cannot forget the student experience. And there are many more resources for students at Cornell. There are many more ways for our students. Barriers have come down and they can engage across racial lines and get involved in all kinds of activities at Cornell to help them grow. But at the end of the day, there are still things that go on that make me say, how much has really changed around here? So SEBA needs to stay on top of the student experience. And John, I tip my hat to you and your board, because I think you have done a significant job. In fact, John is really on Cornell's payroll on the DL, because he spends more time working on not only alumni connected affairs with us and SEBA, but with our students. And you see just what I'm talking about, because you're on the front lines with them. So thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much, John, for what you've done.
No, thank you. I mean, you know, what I've often said to folks, the way that I've always operated in my life, you know, I appreciate the opportunities to do things. I appreciate the open doors in terms of being able to, you know, hopefully make an impact somewhere and to help things move forward and progress. But I don't get there because I opened the door. I didn't open the door. Right. There was a trail that was blazed before that. And literally, even, you know, we talked with the presidents recently, and those episodes are coming up in the next few weeks. And, you know, I think about everything that they did and their boards did and all these incredible individuals have done over time. But again, none of us get there. None of those 13 or 16 folks I spoke with, none of us get there without the five of you establishing what this is and taking your experiences and saying we need to be able to continue to connect, be a family, be a community for one another, so that, like you all mentioned, there are folks that can look to us, right, who are going to be on campus now, look to us and see, yes, I can make it. Not only can I make it because I've seen these examples, but I now can speak to these folks and get their insight and you know, and connect with them and help and have them give me help when, you know, I'm you know, stressed out with prelims or, you know, just trying to figure out what is all this going on right now. And you all established that first line that is literally taking us to this point. So I have to say thank you for all that you've done, for your support over your years, the work over the years that you all have done to make this such an incredible organization. I tip my hat to you all. I know the entire organization does, and especially as we commemorate this 45th year, this 45th anniversary, and look forward to what the next 45 has to offer, we have to make sure that we stop and acknowledge all that you have done. So I want to again say thank you to you all for all of your work, and thank you for being here. I want to thank our listening audience as well for being with us today and checking out what's been going on and really the start of our Cornell Black Alumni Association. Please make sure that you like, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find out more about Young Alumni programs and how to get involved at alumni.cornell.edu/youngalumni and by following the Facebook page at Young Alumni Programs. You can also learn more about the Cornell Black Alumni Association at cbaa1976.com and follow us on social media at cbaa1976 on all platforms. Music for Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. And you can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. If you have ideas for the podcast you would like to share, please email our incredible producer, Amanda Massa, at amanda.massa@cornell.edu. Thank you again to the founders of the Cornell Black Alumni Association, and thank you all for listening. Take care.